Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello and welcome to the Signal of Doom, episode 53. I'm Stu and I'm all alone. Dave's unfortunately come down with the flu. He's in bed, sick as a dog. He's struggling at the moment. So what's going to happen this week? It's going to be a shorter show. It's going to be me running through the news. And Dave's going to tune in when he can. He's going to send in a few audio clips, cut it together. It does mean that we won't know what the other person is saying. So this could be interesting. He'll hear me. I won't be able to hear him. So I'm assuming he's going to get a few shots in and I'm going to have to pay him back the next week, but we'll see how things go. We're going to kick this week off with a short shout out and RIP to Stephen Hawking, who dies at 76 after a 55-year-long battle with motor neurone disease or ALS. He was a huge inspiration for me growing up. Theoretical physicist who worked with some of the greats and really made massive strides in his field, despite a condition that was meant to kill him, and it was meant to kill him about 50 years ago. So the man is an inspiration, and he will be sorely missed. In breaking news, and this came out literally 12 hours ago, we had the Avengers trailer number 3 drop worldwide, and this was the best trailer yet. I haven't had anything near this much excitement for a movie for years now. This trailer was phenomenally well done. It absolutely blew away expectations. We've got a bit of a breakdown, and Dave is going to comment on this at the end, but I just cannot understate how much you need to go and see this movie. So, look, it's a 2-minute trailer, 2-minute 18 seconds. We get new shots. Some of the shots were released in the Comic-Con footage way back before trailer 1 was released. They've since redone the CGI, redone the visuals, the audio, re-released it as this trailer, and it looks phenomenal. We hear Gamora doing some voiceover work. And it's her explaining to the group, especially Tony, who Thanos is. She starts out with, "The entire time I knew him, he only had one goal. To wipe out half the universe. If he gets the Infinity Stones, he can do it with the snap of his fingers. Just like that." So, I mean, this is obviously referencing the comics directly. It's exactly what he did in the comics. He falls in love with death, and as a kind of a tribute to her, to get her to notice him, he snaps his fingers and destroys half of the universe instantly. So we're clearly looking in comic book territory here. We have new shots of War Machine. It's actually featured quite heavily. We get quite a bit of Don Cheadle's War Machine. We see Tony coming in with a bit of comedy. We get a proper first look at Thanos in his full battle armor. Helmet, the full shoulder guards, everything. Looks very cool. We also see quite a bit of new Spidey. So we know that Spidey throws on his regular Spider-Man suit, the fabric suit, when he sees that spaceship and his spider sense goes off. He flies towards it, you know, web swings towards it, gets on board, and it starts taking off. And this is the coolest bit of new footage we got, which is Iron Man flying towards it. His legs in the armor kind of fuse together and form this giant jet engine, which propels him straight towards the spaceship. We know he meets up, and it looks like he gives Spider-Man the Iron Spider armor then, because we know he lands, we're assuming what he's landing on is a Titan, which is Thanos' homeworld. So we see them land there, Iron Man, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange makes it over there, and we also see the Guardians land there, so we're assuming Thor is there as well. We then have Tony coming out with, "We've got one advantage, he's coming to us, we have what Thanos wants, So that's what we use. So we see brief flashes. We see the Eye of Agamotto held by Doctor Strange, obviously hiding the time gem. We see Vision, obviously hiding the mind gem. So what they're going to do is they're going to take those gems to Wakanda, the most defensible location in Earth, and they're going to try to defend from Thanos' assault by going to Wakanda. We see Cap, Black Widow, Rhodey, Banner, Falcon, Vision, Scarlet Witch all travel to Wakanda to meet with T'Challa, who welcomes them. We see the Guardians getting out of the Milano for the first time, which is awesome. And then we get this great little clip with Star-Lord, who says, "Let's talk about this plan of yours. It's good, except it sucks. So let me do the plan, and that way it might be really good." Tony just says, wow. It's hilarious, brilliant. We see Star-Lord with Tony and Spidey, which we've kind of seen those three actors together in behind-the-scenes clips on the sets that they have. So we actually get to see what it turned out looking like, which is very cool. More battle scenes. Falcon, War Machine flying into battle, closely followed by T'Challa and Cap. We see the Hulkbuster gear up properly and get beaten up quite severely. The Hulkbuster features heavily in this trailer. Thanos comes in with the end is near. We see bits of Thor summoning lightning around Groot. We then have Thanos coming in and saying, "When I'm done, half of humanity will still exist." Sounds like trying to convince them that what he's doing isn't all bad. But again, directly from the comic books. So we get flashes of what looks like a flashback, a prequel, showing Gamora being taken by Thanos as a child, being adopted by Thanos so he could convert her and turn her into his child assassin. We get the first full screenshot of the Black Order and Loki standing together. So from left to right, we see Proxima Midnight, Loki, the Ebony Maw, Corvus Glaive, and the last one's a little bit odd. We know it from the comics as Black Dwarf, but it's been confirmed that he's been renamed in this movie to Cull Obsidian. I can only assume it's because Black Dwarf kind of means something different on Earth. So it's a bit of a weird takeaway, but they've renamed him to Cull Obsidian. And we get to see them on screen properly. We get a brilliant little close-up of Ebony Maw later in the trailer on shushing someone. Then he looks proper menacing. I love it. We get quick flash cuts of Bucky loading a rifle, Cap activating his new shield, T'Challa suits up, leading an army into battle, Hulkbuster on the front line of a battlefield, and we see these kind of spires that crash-landed in the first trailer behind what looks like a giant force field. So that kind of lends itself to the fan theory that they're drilling down into the Vibranium Mound to get the last stone, which crash-landed inside that media full of vibranium. So it's an interesting take, because when we say that, we're assuming that Thanos was going to Wakanda anyway to get that stone, the Soul Gem, we're assuming. However, we've already heard, literally spoken from this trailer, that the humans are taking Thanos to Wakanda because it's the most defensible place on the planet. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. We don't know who's taking who where. We know they're in Wakanda. We don't know whether it's Thanos leading them there or whether it's the heroes leading him there. But it does look very cool that they've set up this force field kind of barrier, and we see waves upon waves upon waves of villains, those alien, the four-armed aliens, just running into it and disintegrating, basically. Looked very cool. Thanos is then saying, "Perfectly balanced, as all things should be." We see a small clip from the original Comic-Con footage, which has Doctor Strange creating platforms for Star-Lord to jump so he can traverse the battlefield quickly. It looked very cool. We get a closer look at Scarlet Witch, kind of holding her stomach and looking over. And then we see Doctor Strange with, like, shards of kind of energy sticking out of him or into him. He's kind of screaming. And that's when we get that great shot of Ebony Maw shushing someone, which looks amazing. I'd love to see an Ebony Maw Doctor Strange battle. I think that's a really cool matchup. We see Falcon fly over the Hulkbuster, which is quickly overwhelmed by like a swarm of aliens. Thanos saying, "I hope they remember you," which is an awesome kind of eulogy before he just destroys them. Thanos is then wearing the gauntlet with two stones attached, so it looks like he's already got those first two stones before getting anywhere near Earth. And he basically has this power struggle with Cap, trying to crush him and push him down, and Cap's staring him back and holding him up for a second. You know, big Avengers logo coming to cinemas on the 27th of April. And then we get this great little conversation between Spidey and Doctor Strange. I'm Peter, by the way. Doctor Strange. Spidey comes in with the great line, "Oh, we're using our made-up names? Then I'm Spider-Man." Just fantastic little jabs at humour. We get this closing shot of Spidey web-slinging his way through this crash scene as it all falls down on Titan. It looks like the way we imagined Spider-Man should. We kind of almost got there with the Garfield Spider-Man towards the end of Amazing Spider-Man 2, when he was kind of like flinging through that clock tower. Very similar kind of graphics here, except this is Tom Holland wearing the Iron Spider suit, which looks very cool. So look, that trailer came out last night here in Australia. It was 12:45 in the morning. Tickets are available through Fandango in the States if you want to go and see it. And let's be honest, everybody wants to go and see this movie. So please get out there, have a look. We're going to cross over briefly to Dave now, who's going to have his input in the trailer. Let's see what he thinks.
Hey, gang. Dave here. Hi, everybody. Look, firstly, thank you very much to Stu, who's done a fantastic job with this episode and putting stuff together. I'm actually very ill, so I'm just going to quickly pop in with a few comments. The first one is the Avengers trailer that just dropped yesterday. Look, Stu's done a dissertation to the nation. I'm very impressed. The level of I mean, I learned stuff listening to Stu, which is not uncommon, frankly. But, I mean, he gave you so much detail then that I'm only going to give you, like, the fan reaction, like, just the dumb, you know, fan me. I thought this trailer was probably the most exciting, definitely the most exciting of the trailers I've seen so far for this movie. And I think Stu was saying how pumped he was. So am I. I'm as excited for this film as pretty much any movie that I can remember. As a little kid, when Return of the Jedi came out, I was crazy excited, but I was too young to really sort of grasp it. But Batman 89 would be the last time where just trailers had gotten me to a fever pitch, so that when I entered the cinema, I was just so primed. Like, they did exactly what they would hope, the studios would hope a trailer would do. That was what Batman 89 did for me with the trailers. This is the same. And the trailers for this are, frankly, better, obviously. Clearly, they've got a lot more money and technology. I'm just so excited. Like, the banter, seeing Iron Man, Robert Downey. I have to excuse my coughing, guys. Seeing Robert Downey Jr. interacting with, like, Gamora and then with Star-Lord, fantastic. And the visuals, aren't they spectacular? Where you see the Iron Man suit flying up into the sky. It just looks like it's all going to pop off big time. I am interested to know how Cap can hold back Thanos' hand, especially with, you know, a gauntlet with at least some of the gems in it, or stones, whatever they're called. Yeah, I mean, that was baffling to me. I mean, has Cap maybe... Probably Cap might have one. He might have the Wakanda one by that point. I don't understand otherwise how Cap could possibly hold back Thanos. But, you know, I'm sure the movie will explain that. Look, I don't have all this original stuff to say about it, but I just want to say that this could be I said to Stu just shortly after we were chatting this morning, this could be my favourite movie of all time. I've got a feeling this could surpass, like, Empire, Predator, and probably Batman 89 amongst my top in this, at least in this genre, if not of all time. And I think if Avengers Infinity War could supplant those as well. I think it just looks absolutely fantastic. And what a time to be alive, even when you're as sick as me. yeah, kids, rush out, get your advance tickets. This is something to watch.
Okay. The other thing that comes over from last week is our Jessica Jones Season 2 spoiler review. So we're going to do a heavy spoiler review for the entire season. You've had about 2 weeks to see it, so hopefully most of you have seen it. If you haven't seen it, jump forward. Jump forward, ignore this little bit. Dave's going to chime in at the end. So I'm just going to run through what I thought, which characters really stood out. And also I'm going to go through as many Easter eggs as I picked up on watching it for the first time. This is not going to be a perfect run-through, but let's see how we go. So, all in all, I thought this season was just behind Season 1. It didn't quite live up to Season 1, and I think that's mostly because we were missing Kilgrave. I'm a huge fan of David Tennant's Kilgrave. I think he's one of the greatest villains the MCU and Marvel Netflix shows have ever had. He was almost perfect, and I'm glad we did get to see him in this season. In episode 11, we finally got a bit of Kilgrave as a kind of an apparition from her mind that he's etched and permanently stuck in her brain, which is a really cool take, and I'm kind of hoping that that's where they go for season 3, that he becomes this kind of like the dark side of her conscience, telling her what to do. So really cool getting to see him again. We got to see Jessica Jones's mother. Now that's possibly the biggest spoiler of this season, knowing that she wasn't an orphan when she was picked up, but that her mother was experimented on the same as her and became this kind of uncontrollable monster who just couldn't control her rage, and when she got angry, she got stronger and stronger and was able to do terrible, terrible things. Much stronger than Jessica Jones, by the way, which is really cool. It's a great look at how this dysfunctional family is going to fit together after years of being apart and trying to fit each other into their lives and understand each other, where they're coming from. Obviously, they both want to do the right thing. But it's a really conflicting message on where that right thing is, how to do it, whether you should care about collateral damage, whether you should care about other people. So it is a really great look at that. We get a brief flash of Simpson at the beginning giving his inhaler to Patsy Walker, or Trish Walker, who we know by the end of this season does become Hellcat after those experiments gone wrong, or gone right, I suppose. She picks up that amazing reflex where she catches the phone on her foot. So we know in the next season we're going to get more of a Hellcat vibe instead of a Trish Walker or a Patsy Walker vibe. As far as cameos, Easter eggs goes, we've spoken briefly about the Whizzer, who showed up in the first few episodes, who was an original 40s character, 1941, I think he came out, and was on the side of the Invaders, which is a pre or during World War II team up led by Cap, Namor, and the original Human Torch, Jim Hammond, with the sidekicks Bucky and Toro, the boy Human Torch. And they kind of get their numbers built up after this conflict that we get to see. It unfolded in the Invaders comics that came out in 1975, where we see a bunch of new members get added to try to save the team because the Red Skull brainwashed half of them, so they're battling against each other. It's really cool to see the Whizzer. Some of these other really, really, you know, Z-list characters that appeared for a couple of issues back in 75, set in 1941, 1942. It's really fun to see them. We also get a great little piece early on, which I don't know if it's an Easter egg. If it is an Easter egg, it's not going to be for a few years yet. But the wizard starts talking about lizard people wearing human skin and that Jay-Z is one of them. Now, this could just be your typical crazy talk. I mean, lizard people are kind of the go-to crazy motif. But we know that Skrulls are coming in the MCU. We know that Captain Marvel is going to deal with the Kree-Skrull War. We know that we've had Skrulls coming for a while in the main MCU. And we kind of think that that's what's going to lead the arc in Phase 4, post-Avengers 4, Infinity War 2, whatever it's going to be. So if those Skrulls do, in fact, take and replace Jay-Z, then this is a cool kind of early Easter egg saying that the Skrulls are here and this secret invasion has actually been happening for a while now. And they are taking people of influence. So, look, this leads into, like, Secret Wars kind of territory, which is amazing. I'd love to see that happen in the comic books. And I'd love to see it happen in the MCU. We get a few kind of obvious Spider-Man references where we see with great power comes great mental illness from the Wizard. We get scroty senses tingling. Like, there's a lot of great little nods at Spider-Man and just having fun at him and his expense. In episode 6, we get this weird paint sex scene. Kind of odd, but you'll notice that he's only got four colours paint. Yellow, green, red, and purple. Obviously representative of the four major Netflix characters to date. Yellow, green, red, purple becomes Iron Fist... Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Daredevil, and Jessica Jones. We notice that when they're rolling around, they knock over the purple tin, Jessica Jones's tin, which she is then lying in. Later on, they actually knock over the yellow tin, which is kind of a Luke Cage, Jessica Jones deal. So potential spoilers for next season, I suppose, that they are going to get back together. We then get a nice little reference towards the end when Patsy Walker finally wakes up and the doc comes out with, you've used up 2 out of your 9 lives. Clearly a reference to cats, felines. So we get a nice little Hellcat reference there. Towards the end of the movie, we also see them travel to Westchester, which is where that carnival is, which is where the final scenes go down. Just for comic book fans, we're all familiar with Westchester being the home of the X-Men and Professor Xavier's childhood home, which is very cool. In terms of the characters, we got Dr. Carl Malus, who was kind of the creator of these monsters, who is a regular villain, mostly from Captain America. And as a villain in the comics, he also enhanced and gave powers to villains. So straight out of the comic books. Very early on, we got Trish talking to one of her guests, Maynard Tybalt, who is a comic book character called a Ringmaster, who leads the Circus of Crime, and no, I'm not making that up. A bit odd, because we did actually get a character called Ringmaster in Iron Fist. He was one of the people running that underground fight ring that Colleen Wing attended. So in episode 8, we got our Stan Lee cameo, which was very cool to see. A poster in the background at the Port Authority, but maintaining his having been in every single season of TV, Netflix, and every MCU movie. In episode 12, we got a great little scene with Turk Barrett, a weapons dealer who has been in Daredevil and Luke Cage, now providing a gun to Carrie Ann Moss's character, who has a brilliant arc in this movie, getting kind of duped by that faith healer after receiving the news that she had ALS. And she kind of goes full dark side and convinces people to commit murder on her behalf. It's really cool. It is a very dark TV show, but it is so fun to watch. It's gripping. You don't realize how quickly you're getting through these episodes either. Final thing I'll add is we didn't get this season. We didn't get any Claire Temple sightings, the night nurse. And this is the first season of Netflix TV that we haven't had a night nurse show up. Which is a little disappointing. I really like that character. Rosario Dawson plays this night nurse really well. It would have been cool to kind of renew those links that they formed in The Defenders. Because we didn't get any other cameos from any other Marvel Netflix character that has their own solo title. You could argue that Jaren Hogarth is here. I mean, this is where she originated. She also appeared in Iron Fist. We did get a brief sighting of Foggy for literally one scene, who gets shut down very quickly. But look, overall, this season is really good TV. It's 13 episodes of really solid TV. It's one of the only Netflix shows that actually picks up in the latter half. The first, say, 5 episodes that got released early to the critics are good, but they're not great. We get a lot of mystery. There's no payoff. There's no reveals. So it feels like a slower movie than it is if you've got to run those 5 episodes together. Post episode 6. So episode 6 is where it picks up. That's where we get the reveal of the monster being played by McTeer. We see that as Jessica Jones's mother. And suddenly that story and that relationship changes drastically. It picks up hugely. And I think from there on, it kind of keeps going at that level. It keeps getting better and better. We see Patsy Walker kind of degrade, become a full-on addict, get crushed and changed. We see Jessica Jones kind of go through this, what do I do? This is my mother that I thought was dead. Do I try to help her? Do I save her? Even though if it weren't my mother, I would obviously be handing her to the police, getting her on the raft. It's a really cool season. It's a great TV show. I'd highly recommend watching it. So what we're going to do now is we're going to head over to Dave to see what he's got to say on the subject.
It's not, how can I say, it's slow burn, but in a good way. It's not too slow. I thought Luke Cage was very enjoyable, but was very slow burn, and I could understand someone getting bored. I think this Jessica Jones is just at a really groovy pace. I sound like I'm dialing in from 1975 now, but I'm sorry, but I don't know. There's nothing much I can really say that Stu hasn't said. He's got into heaps of detail. I simply don't have the breath or energy to do that, but I would say that this Jessica Jones is a top tier show. It's right up there in terms of the best sort of Marvel Netflix product. The performances across the board are fantastic. I haven't listened to Stu's in-depth spoiler review because Michelle and I are still closing in towards the end, and we'll get there by the end of this week. But seriously, if you're sitting on the fence, you should definitely go check this one out. It's a good one. And the performances are fantastic. It's a really well-performed show as well. Like, good writing, nice soundtrack behind it, like a sort of jazz soundtrack behind it, great PI feel. If you like your Rockford Files, well, take away the comedy and mix in a bit of sort of the, you know, more of the now. And it's a good PI show as well. It ticks a lot of boxes, actually. Jessica Jones is a really good show. And this is a particularly strong season, so yeah, check it out. I must say, I really enjoyed the actress playing Patsy Walker, Trish, and also, obviously, I mean, Jessica Jones is fantastic, and also Malcolm. So the main leads are really, really good. It's an excellent show, so check it out.
Okay, in other news, we have our first test screening from Deadpool 2, and it's getting a bad rap. So how much we look into this, I would take it with basically zero input. Let's remind ourselves that with a test screening, you are viewing a movie before the final CGI, before the final audio editing, video editing, all that sort of stuff. It's also not necessarily the final product. These are scenes that they are testing out to see if they work or not. They've often got 2 or 3 scenes lined up as replacements for some of them. They are testing some jokes to see whether those jokes work with the audience, whether they don't. It is exactly what it's meant to be. It is a test screening to see if that movie is good. If they get hugely positive feedback, which we've seen before with movies like Guardians 2, they can then... they kind of struggle, because at that point, what do you change? Like, you just keep going down the path you're going down. You think, okay, everything's on track, let's finish it and move on. When you get negative feedback, it's often actually better for the film. You get people being critical and not thinking and looking at it through rose-coloured glasses. They look at it critically, they see exactly what they like and don't like, and you can kind of make changes based on that. Now, it doesn't always work. Sometimes it is too big a mess to change. And that is kind of what we're getting from these Deadpool 2 test screenings. Whether you read anything into this or not, I don't know. We know of only one test screening, and I think only one or two people have broken the contracts and media silence to say that they thought it was a mess. We know that they are reshooting. Josh Brolin has confirmed that they're reshooting in Canada. I think he says, I'm up here right now in snowy Vancouver doing reshoots for Deadpool. Given that it's a satire of all superhero movies, especially Marvel movies, how can you not? Which is great, making fun of what's happening in recent movies. We know that, according to a now deleted tweet, the plot of Deadpool 2 was empty and they wasted Vanessa, the love interest of Deadpool. Look, we know that the Domino and Cable characters both went down really well, so a lot of these reshoots are focusing on those characters. I wouldn't read too much into this. I don't think there's going to be a lot behind it. Ultimately, though, we have lost the creative team that made Deadpool 1. This is a different set of creative influences. Ryan Reynolds is obviously still there, and he is a big influence, but a lot of things have changed. Whether it's changed for the better, whether it's changed for the worse, I suppose we're just going to have to wait and find out. We don't have long to wait now. It's coming out very quickly.
Okay, moving to the next item that I want to discuss. It's these Deadpool 2 test screening reactions. Look, when the news came through that the first screenings, test screenings were reportedly going poorly, and this is basically based off one guy on Twitter who since deleted his tweets but was kind of slamming them. Look, I was very concerned just purely as a Deadpool fan because I love Deadpool so much and I love the movie so much, the first movie and Ryan Reynolds and just the whole thing. And I'm just so hyped for it that this kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting it. And probably that's why I reacted. And I said to Stu, like in the notes, I don't know if I can even handle this, man. Like, seriously. Like, dude, I'm fucking gutted at first, you know, hearing it. But then I kind of recalibrated, researched it a bit more. And it's one guy's opinion, frankly. And they were saying that it needed more Cable and Domino. And they're doing reshoots to add more of that in. Now, I'm down for that. Like, I want Cable and Domino in this movie. So, look, Stu, I just listened to his point of view. And he's on the mark. Stu's hitting home runs this episode, guys. Like, I'm coming in with some real terrible, feeble pitching. You know, my apologies. But I wanted to get on the record here that... I mean, Stu and I both have rose-coloured glasses on Deadpool, you know, as a character. And I am sort of like, I was so surprised, not by the quality of the first movie, but by the box office. Like, it actually blew me away how popular that became, and I just thought it was incredible. I just hope for another really good movie. And the writers are the same, and the stars the same. The directors have changed, that's true. I mean, they've got the guy who's done John Wick. But, I mean, that's not, you know... that's not too bad. I think Reynolds is still there. Ryan Reynolds is still there driving the bus, and the same riders are on it. So, look, I think it's going to be a different flavour. It may have more of a superhero-y sort of flavour. I don't know, but, I mean, the plot of the first movie was fantastic, but it wasn't like this super complicated plot. It was kind of like it went round in a circle kind of thing. It was really cool. I'm not going to sort of like get my torches out and my pitchforks out. I'm just going to chill out, relax. They're doing the reshoots, trust in the process, and we'll see when I'll be wearing my Deadpool cap and t-shirt, that's for sure. That's for damn sure. So, yeah. When I first read this, I was panicking, and Stu saw my panic in the show notes. But since then, I've kind of chilled back on it and just realised this might be one guy out there with a point to prove, trying to make a name for himself on the internet, you know, breaking non-disclosure agreements all over the shop, which, by the way, is just unprofessional. But anyway, peace out, and that's my opinion on Deadpool 2 and the supposedly poor test screening results. Thank you.
Also coming out this week, we saw the drop of the Fantastic Beasts 2 trailer, The Crimes of Grindelwald. Very cool trailer. Really fun, really high energy. We see all the favourite characters are back. We also get a better shot of Grindelwald, looking really quite menacing, with the contacts that make him look a little bit Marilyn Manson-ish. I didn't hate the image of Johnny Depp. I thought I would. So it's weird to see him in a role that I don't hate. I think he's kind of moving away from the just drunk pirate persona, which he's carried for the last 10 years. Really, really cool trailer, high energy. Really recommend a view. Jump on YouTube, find the Fantastic Beasts trailer. Came out this week. It's really good, worth a watch. In other news, Ava DuVernay, who was the writer and director of the A Wrinkle in Time movie, which is out now, has been picked to direct a New Gods movie for Warners. DuVernay was also the first pick to direct Black Panther before it was eventually given to Ryan Coogler after she passed. She has an amazing track record of film. She was heavily involved in Selma, which won Oscar nominations, Oscar wins. It was an incredible movie. I think this is a really strong pick for a New Gods movie. The problem I'm having is the idea of a New Gods. I think this will rely on the characters like Steppenwolf and Apocalypse and Darkseid, kind of, not Apocalypse, Darkseid, working in these DC movies. And so far, Steppenwolf was easily the worst part of, except maybe for the lip and the moustache gate, but Steppenwolf was the worst character in Justice League. So whether we're going to actually get around eventually to getting a New Gods movie, I don't know. I'm hoping this is post-Flashpoint. I'm hoping we get a massive change. We get a completely new roster. They can turn this around. But they can't just massage this into place. It's a case of stop, reboot, start again, or go through something major like a Flashpoint, de-age everyone, take them to a new universe. There's plenty of options there. This is a kind of... DC has kind of made the name for themselves doing those massive events where you've got crossovers between universes, crossovers between dimensions, time travel. Like, all these things are really common in the DC universe, not so much in Marvel. I'd really love to see that this happens to the DC universe. Okay, we also got new information for the villain of Luke Cage Season 2. Rosalie Carbone. So originally a Punisher character. She's going to be played by Annabelle Sioria, who was in The Sopranos. So it's an interesting pick. It does lend itself to maybe a Punisher cameo, which would be cool. But more than that, Luke Cage has always been a very physical hero. He's always punched his way out of something. You don't give a man unbreakable skin and that kind of strength and then have him come up against a Kilgrave. It would never work. So it's interesting that they've given him a female villain to play off. Because typically the female villains are better at that kind of manipulation, that kind of villainous vibes where they can control a situation. In comic books especially, that's where they've kind of really shone through. It's rare to get a physical powerhouse in a female character. Obvious exceptions, like we've had Captain Marvels and things like that. But in villains, this is an interesting turnaround because we're not going to be able to see Luke Cage just go ahead and punch this problem in the face. So it's a cool villain that we see coming up. Season 2 is dropping June 22, so that's really coming up quick. 3 months away and we get another Netflix season. Like, this year is turning out brilliantly for nerds. It's fantastic. In other news, we have Joe and Anthony Russo commenting on why Hawkeye hasn't appeared in any promo footage for Infinity War. Now, They released this before the third trailer was released, and again, third trailer, we don't see any Hawkeye. This is despite him having a much meatier role in Age of Ultron and Civil War, after fans criticized his level of input in Avengers 1, that he was basically a waste of space. So in Age of Ultron, we get a much meatier role for him, showing his family, showing his heritage. We get Civil War, where he's playing a much more pivotal role, and taking down other heroes, which is cool to see. It kind of puts him up a level in terms of what we expect from him, power levels, that sort of thing. So the Russo brothers have confirmed that he is in the movie, but he's on his own path after the events of Civil War. So you remember at the end of Civil War, he was one of the ones arrested. He was on Cap's side. And fans have speculated that this could mean that his family will be killed and he will adopt the persona of Ronan, which was his kind of darker version of Hawkeye. Heavy on the blacks, heavy on the mood, not loving life. Which I think is a really cool way to take him. I think Jeremy Renner is an actor that's better than the role they've given him. Hawkeye so far hasn't been a great character to play in the MCU. He's a worthy inclusion in the MCU. He's been fantastic in the comic books. And Jeremy Renner is a good actor. I think using him and giving him a more meaty story or a darker story could really, really help. But, you know, let's see what Dave thinks. He might disagree completely. So we're going to cut over to Dave and see what he thinks.
Okay, so Dave's opinion on why Hawkeye hasn't appeared in the promo footage and the Russo brothers saying that he's on his own path after the events of Civil War. Stu just made an excellent point. And I must say I'm agreeing with Stu. When he's not here in the office recording with me, it seems Stu seems to mentally know the right things to say. I'm kidding, of course. No, look, Hawkeye potentially being something like Ronan, I think it's cool. And frankly, I mean, Stu just said it. Jeremy Renner's a good actor. He's been in plenty of good movies. Very dependable actor. Hawkeye hasn't exactly been the most challenging or fulfilling role of all time. He's done well with what he's had, but it hasn't been a lot. Civil War was probably his best moment. Or Age of Ultron, maybe, in the house with his girlfriend. Could have been probably the highlights package for Hawkeye. And that's not saying much. Look, I hope Hawkeye's got to change it up a little bit in terms of the movies to get any kind of interest. If he's got like a little subplot where he's Ronan and we see maybe him kicking some people's ass a bit harder than usual, doing something like that, I'm down for it. And I think that would work well. And it would at least give Hawkeye a little bit of a subplot. I mean, Hawkeye is a cool character, in the comics. I mean, I love Matt Fraction's Hawkeye, and he's also in stuff like West Coast Avengers. He's a classic Avenger, so he certainly deserves to be there. It's been hard for him with such a packed entourage around him inside like a 2.5 hour or 2 hour 15 minute movie. So I hope that he has a subplot worthy of something here. And I think, as Stu said, the adoption of Ronan, I mean, it's a change as well. It's a change as good as a holiday. And I dig it. So change it up. Let's see Ronan. I think at one point Hawkeye may even have been Daredevil at some time in the comics. I never read this period in the comics, but I believe he was. I mean, you know, why not Hawkeye, I suppose? But like, it goes to show he's more than bow and arrow, unless he was using a bow and arrow while he was Daredevil, which would have been hilarious. But yeah, change it up. We want to see Ronan. Ronan, Ronan, Ronan.
Okay, we've also, from the Russo brothers, had confirmation that we will not be seeing Captain Marvel in Infinity War. She's going to be joining the team for Avengers 4. That has been confirmed, but that will follow her solo movie debut. So we won't be getting any Brie Larson cameos, which kind of suggests that she is off-world. Obviously, if she was on world and on Earth, she'd be kind of aware of this earth-shattering battle happening in Wakanda. So she must be off-world somewhere, dragged in because of the Infinity Stones. Look, it's really cool that we finally get some confirmation. I love Captain Marvel, so I'm looking forward to it. I'm disappointed that we don't get a little more Captain Marvel, but we'll live with it. In other news, and this is up and down a little bit. The original Wonder Woman actress, Linda Carter, has been vocal in the last week about how Wonder Woman deserved an Oscar, or at least an Oscar nomination. And she's kind of been a little bit angry with social media, saying that this movie really deserved more than it got. I mean, superhero movies typically don't do well. Superhero movies are not fantastic, like, films. They are fun, they are great visually, and you see most of the nominations come in visual effects, in makeup, in CGI come in nominations. We certainly saw that at this year's Oscars. It's very rare for a superhero film to be made to such a high standard where the actors start getting nominated. So it took the Joker in Dark Knight to kind of get a nomination and actually got a win, posthumously. But it's rare for most superhero movies to get that kind of critical acclaim. And whether it's fair or not, I don't know. I'm not that big a film critic. But it's an interesting kind of quandary that superhero movies are kind of viewed as lesser movies, which I don't think is fair. Typically, though, they are not made to be that artistic and that correct, because that's not the audience. Their audience wants fun, they want movement, they want action, they want comedy, they want some kind of characters they can, like, pin up on a wall, make action figures of, not a kind of character that they go home and they think about for a week and they discuss the nuances of the performance. They're different markets. Look, ultimately, it comes down to money, and the market isn't there for that kind of film in the superhero genre. We might get a couple. We might get one or two. If we get a smaller side project, Marvel and DC are both now looking towards more obscure directors, giving them complete control. Things like what we saw with James Gunn's Guardian, what we saw with Taika Waititi's Thor Ragnarok, what we saw with Ryan Coogler's Black Panther, mostly solo films basically not connected to the MCU, with unique directors giving their vision, properly their vision. So, look, this could work out really well. But I suppose we've got to wait and see. So Linda Carter, as well as doing this, is also actually getting awarded with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame next month. So that's fantastic news. She was brilliant as an original Wonder Woman. She did a lot for female characters. Because she was one of the properly independent, strong female characters that we saw in a time where that wasn't popular. Really breaking barriers, which is fantastic. I'm sure Dave's got some praise to land on Linda Carter coming up. So we're going to cross over to Dave and see what he can do.
Thank you, Stu. Stu's 1,000% correct. I have a lot of praise to lay on Linda Carter. Look, as I struggle not to die. Linda Carter, Wonder Woman, late 70s, was replayed endlessly in the 80s on TV, which is clearly where I saw it, watching it with my sister after school on TV. She was Wonder Woman to me. Forever, basically, until pretty much Gal Gadot's movies. And I think Linda Carter trailblazed. I think she was beautiful. She was diplomacy itself, strength, everything, really, elegance, smart. Basically, she covered the whole list of attributes that all sum up Wonder Woman. It was a wonderful performance. And it was a lot of fun, too. And watching it as a kid, before I even read comic books, I knew who Wonder Woman was. I appreciated that she was a very cool character. And I put her up there, like, in my imagination, with the Batmans and the Supermans from a very young age. And I think that... I mean, the fact she's only getting a star now, I don't understand. Like, she should have had this star on the Walk of Fame 30 years ago. If not more, and it's like Mark Hamill getting a star. It's like, how come these stars were so delayed? I don't know the politics behind it all. But I just want to say all praise to Linda Carter. I really hope she gets in the Wonder Woman sequel. She's totally open to it, apparently. They're working on that. I think that would be fantastic. She really, truly defined the character, gave it a huge push, which lasted years after the show. Like, the show was off the air, I think, by the end of the 70s, and with the replay and syndication it had and continues to have, she always kept the flame alive for Wonder Woman, and she's just a fabulous woman. And all praise to her. Thank you, Linda.
Okay, in more leaked news, we have interesting information regarding Spider-Man Homecoming 2. They've put out a casting call for some new characters that hint at potential villains. So there are two calls that they're making. The first one is they're looking for a baddie with elevated ideas. They've specified any ethnicity and any gender, but they need to be aged between 30 and 45. So they're looking for kind of the parental kind of age range. So roughly Peter Parker's, their level of high school age. Their parents would be around the 30 to 45 range. So similar to kind of like a Michael Keaton's role. But a baddie with elevated ideas, I think, is a cool way to describe this character. So we're clearly looking at one of the smarter villains, not someone like a Scorpion, not someone like a Rhino. We're looking at someone more like a Doc Ock, which is my choice. We've also got something like a Ben Reilly, maybe, which would be very cool. The other casting call I've made is a high school student with leading man qualities, capable of holding his own with Tom Holland. Any ethnicity again, but this time male, aged between 18 and 24. So they're going for someone probably transferring into the high school to meet with Peter. Again, they're kind of able to shift these characters around without any problems. So they're specifying any ethnicity. That doesn't matter at all. Unless you're, related, blood related to a character that's already established, you're kind of open to ethnicity at this point. I think everyone's agreeing in that. But the age range is interesting. It is going to be a student at the high school. Could be like a Peter Parker clone or something. Could be the son or daughter of like a Doc Ock character. Look, there's a lot of possibilities here. So this is something that Dave's got quite a bit to say, hopefully. So we're going to cross over to Dave and see what he thinks about this Spider-Man Homecoming casting call.
Thanks, Stu. Look, I do have something to say, and I wish I was at full strength so I could give this the passion it deserves, because Spider-Man Homecoming I so enjoyed, and Spider-Man Homecoming 2 I'm just so pumped for after all these Avengers movies. Let's turn straight to the casting news. A baddie with elevated ideas. Straight away I'm thinking Doc Ock. Stu said it to me, and my mind's just spinning with that. Obviously, we saw a very good Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2, but that was like more than, I don't know, but roughly 15 years ago. I'm so down to see Doc Ock appear in a modern Spider-Man, like a fresher take. I think if you're going to do Spider-Man, which they're clearly doing, if you can't do Green Goblin because he's kind of been done a couple of times, then yeah, let's go Doc Ock. And let's make Doc Ock a really interesting character. Let's use the innovations that we've made in the last 15 years to maybe give him... He was done in a fairly kind of like nuanced way in the original Spider-Man 2, but I think that there's a lot more room they could move. You could potentially have him crushing on Aunt May as well, which is something that happened in the comics. All sorts of different avenues you could go down, so I'd definitely be down for that. Now, as for the other casting call, the high school student with leading man qualities, I mean, if we assume that it's not Miles Morales, I'm not sure if he's been cast yet. I know he was mentioned. Well, obviously, Miles Morales. I mean, Stu's got here Ben Reilly, which obviously opens up the Clone Saga. A can of worms, I don't think they'll go down now. I think they've got enough problems. Just with the... When I say problems, I mean Sony have... Trying to set up Spider-Verse. I'm not sure if the Clone Saga is something you want to be going down right at the beginning. So in that sense, I'd probably say possibly not Ben Reilly, but he's definitely a possible. And I think that's a good choice by Stu. But I'm sure there's a lot of, like, teenage-style villains that you could do around the age, or heroes that you could do around the age of... Peter. just hearing about this, I wish I was kind of more well so I could really gather all my attentions on it, but Spider-Man Homecoming 2, coming fresh off Avengers, what would be Avengers, is it, am I right in saying 4? It's going to be a major movie. And I think we're going to see, we've already seen so much Tom Holland Spider-Man in the Avengers Infinity War trailers, so you know he's going to play a large role there, and Marvel are really positioning to bring him back to the forefront. So, yeah, I don't have heaps of massive opinions or even casting choices for Doc Ock. I think Doc Ock could be played by anyone in that 30 to 45 age range. You could even go 50, anywhere in there. Brilliant scientist, a bit crazy. Doc Ock has had some of the most cool stories in Spider-Man's history, including kind of in recent years, Superior Spider-Man. He's an amazing character. So God bless you, Doc Ock. I always rate Doc Ock. So yeah, bring it on, Marvel.
Okay, in other news, we have Danny Boyle, famous for Trainspotting, famous for Slumdog Millionaire, is hedged to direct the final Daniel Craig James Bond movie. Now, it has been almost, well, all but confirmed. Danny Boyle has come out and said that he will do the movie if the script is good enough. The script itself is interesting. It was originally thought that the script had been written, and it was written by the same duo that had done Skyfall and Spectre. So 50-50. But he's brought in, Danny Boyle has brought in a writer that he's worked with before, and it looks like he's going from scratch. And the two of them are working together. They've had a few ideas, and between them they are coming up with the last, well, the next James Bond movie, the last for Daniel Craig. It's a great pick for director. I love Danny Boyle's work. This could be a really, really cool movie, especially because Danny Boyle is so involved in the writing process this time. So we get a director and writers working together. That always bodes well. When you get this script that's being shopped around to different directors, it's rarely a good sign. It often means the script is weaker or that these directors that they're picking don't fit that kind of story. Directors obviously have a wheelhouse that they like to go to, whether it's action, whether it's comedy, whether it's romance. They've all got their own wheelhouses. So we know this is going to fit directly in the Danny Boyle wheelhouse. We know this is going to be really strong with character development. We know we're going to get some pretty cool action scenes. Like he is great with moving camera shots. So look, this is great news. It's also good news that we know that Daniel Craig can work with Danny Boyle. We know that actor-director pairing is going to work. So we hope great things come out of this. This is also going to be the 25th James Bond movie, which is a massive milestone. We saw the 50th anniversary a couple of years ago with Skyfall. We've now got the 25th movie in the series, which is incredible. Speaking of movies, we now have, and this is hilarious, Jesse Eisenberg hopes to return as Lex Luthor in future DCEU films. His take on Lex Luthor was wacky and out there, and most fans were kind of on the fence about it, at best. A lot of people didn't like it. They thought it was too wacky, too crazy. Lex is meant to be this calculating, controlling supervillain, and Jesse Eisenberg kind of went way too wacky and out there. So, look, good on you if you get another role. I'm hopeful that we don't, to be honest. I'm hoping something else happens, but we'll see what comes around. Now, on the flip side of Luthor, we have Superman, and we've got a new movie coming up, an animated movie called Teen Titans Go, which is a feature film coming out later this year. It's done in a kind of cutesy cartoon animation style, mostly focusing on, obviously, the Teen Titan characters. But inside that, we have Superman, we have Wonder Woman, and we have Green Lantern all showing up. And the big news is Superman is going to be voiced by Nick Cage. This is some of the greatest news I've heard this week. Nick Cage is one of the biggest Superman fans on the planet. And that's not as an actor. That's not he wants to play him, although he does. this man is a comic book nerd. He loves his Superman to the point where this man bought a Superman, an Action Comics number one, I think, sold it for more than $2 million a few years ago. He was tapped to play and was... There's some amazing footage if you go down on the internet to play Superman in Tim Burton's version, which was meant to come out in the 90s but never got round. Look, he is so totally obsessed by Superman. It's amazing that he gets to voice him finally. But we do get a few cameos in this movie. We know that Nick Cage is doing Superman. We have the singer-songwriter Halsey co-starring as Wonder Woman. We get Little Yachty playing Green Lantern, which is a weird kind of cameo. In terms of the main characters in this movie, we know we have Robin, who's voiced by Scott Menville. We have Starfire, voiced by Hinden Walsh. Raven, voiced by Tara Strong. Cyborg, by Kerry Payton. And we also have Beast Boy, by Greg Sipes. And they are actually chasing Kristen Bell to direct, who'd be another great kind of, not cameo, but an amazing get for this movie. She's a fantastic actress. This project is sounding more and more fun by the minute. Hopefully it does really well. I like animated features doing well because they rarely do that well in cinemas when you're talking about superhero movies. They actually rarely get a cinematic release, which this one is. So, look, this is already a good move. This is already good news. Hopefully we get further. And Dave wants to chime in on this one as well, so we're going to cross over to Dave, see what he thinks about Nick Cage's Superman. Spoiler alert, I think Dave is going to love this news.
Well, that's right, kids. Stu's picked it. Dave, sick as a dog. Yeah, on his ventilator. Does love this news. Nick Cage as Superman has always been a dream of mine since the late 90s when he was tapped in, what was it, Life and Death of Superman, whatever it was called. The sort of quasi-Kevin Smith-ridden, Tim Burton-directed movie that never was. There's some cool footage and there's a great documentary with John Snepp who does, you know, the story of that movie that never was. It's great. It's really worth a watch. But, yeah, I mean, look, I'm just so pleased that someone who is a genuine comic book fan and a megastar in Nick Cage, who's consistently, I mean, he called his son Kal-El, and has consistently stood up for the comic book genre. And he's just a huge fan. You see, there's pictures of him at comic conventions and stuff, like buying up Rare Comics. The guy puts his money where his mouth is. He's a cool guy. He's one of my favourite actors. And I'm so pleased that he has a chance to play Superman in this. Now, Stu obviously is a lot younger than me, and he's announced Halsey is Wonder Woman. I have no idea who Halsey is. I just Googled her. She's a singer. Congratulations, she's Wonder Woman. And Lil Yachty, also unknown to me, is playing, he looks like a rap guy, is playing Green Lantern in Teen Titans Go. And I say more power to them all. Like, hell yeah. Teen Titans Go is just a nutty show. I occasionally do catch it. And I love that it's getting a feature release, and I hope it does well. And I hope it's not just a tiny limited release. And I guess getting these big names is a big step. So more power to them, and more power to Nick Cage. Congratulations. And hey, let's not forget Halsey and Lil Yachty as well, because God bless them as well.
Okay, ahead of our Avengers Infinity War premiere coming out 27th of April in the States, AMC is hosting a 30-plus hour MCU marathon. So they're going through every movie, start to finish, in the lead-up to that premiere. That is going to be an intense viewing experience for anyone in that cinema. Luckily, there's a couple of missteps. You can get a few hours sleep, maybe. I mean, 30-plus hours, and then to go into Infinity War. If it were me, you kind of want to go into Infinity War fresh, don't you? So you can take in everything properly. Do a 30-plus hour marathon, sure, I would love to do that, but maybe do it a day or two ahead. Because you can imagine sitting there for 30 hours and then going into Infinity War. Your mind's going to be shattered by that point. Look, like I said, luckily there's a few missteps. Maybe you can get some sleep in lesser important movies. I mean, Phase 2, you kind of hit things like Thor. Dark World, you can have a few hours sleep there. You could probably sleep through bits of Doctor Strange, Incredible Hulk early on. But, like, that's so early in the piece, you probably wouldn't want to sleep then. Look, you're going to have to plan this out pretty well if you're going to take this on. This is a hell of a challenge. Man, that cinema is going to stink when that movie's done. That's going to be terrible. Good luck to anyone doing it. By the way, if you wanted to watch the MCU from start to finish, including tie-in shows, Netflix shows, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., one-shot little clips and movies on the internet, this whole process takes more than 5 days now. That is intense. If you want to go and watch all the MCU, you need to set aside a week. That's blowing people's minds. It's incredible. I love that stuff. Okay, moving on. We have new reviews for the new released Tomb Raider movie. Led by Alicia Vikander, who is one of my favourite actresses. Her role in Ex Machina was mind-blowingly good. I'd recommend that movie above almost all others. And this project is getting really mixed reviews, this new Tomb Raider movie. So the first response, mixed, possibly weak. It's getting around the 50% mark on Rotten Tomatoes, 5.2 average rating, 49 out of 100 on Metacritic. It's middling at best. This is feeling like another kind of average run-through for what should be a really cool character. We've seen a lot of Lara Croft over the years. We kind of associated her more with video games and, well, I mean, kind of more with Angelina Jolie at this point. Those movies were okay. Cool to see, different take, but okay. So, look, this is unfortunate. Alicia Vikander is a really talented actress, and we know she worked really hard to get this film out. So this is kind of unfortunate that this film isn't doing so well. It's another one on the kind of this train ride of video games being turned into movies and kind of getting pretty average results. It's very rare for a video game, original content, original video game, to get turned into a movie and actually have properly good results. Which is odd because you think of video games often as kind of like a movie experience. You've got cutscenes, and it's kind of like imagine running through that level or that stage or that phase of play perfectly, where you don't make any mistakes. You don't have a lot of character encounters. You don't slow down that much. You could run this game. Often these games only last 2 or 3 hours if you play perfectly. Like, it's a perfect thing for a movie, yet so many of them are missteps. It's weird to think why that's happening. The only thing I can come up with is that these actors and writers kind of take the lazy way out, and they just go directly from the scripts, and it doesn't quite work out. Like, we kind of expect different things. From a comic book point of view, we want things represented exactly as they are in the books. We love that level of detail. We love those little Easter eggs. When it comes to video games, we're a little less inclined to want exactly what we saw. We want that feeling. And that feeling is almost impossible to get. When you're involved in a story and you're controlling these characters, you get this new feeling of input. Whereas when you're watching it on the screen and you can't change the outcome, you can't make it run faster or slower or make a character pick up a different kind of weapon or storyline, you kind of lose that input, and it needs to be something special to kind of force you back into that. So look, unfortunately Tomb Raider is not doing so well. I mean, it's good news for Black Panther, which is continuing its phenomenal run. It's passed $578 million in the States as a domestic total, which is well inside the top 10 now. and internationally it's grossed $1.12 billion, which is more than I thought it ever would. It's close to 50-50 between the state and the rest of the world in terms of input. This movie is just smashing every record it comes across. If you look at the all-time domestic movie rank, it's sitting at number 7. As we said it would last time, it's overtaken Dark Knight and Rogue One. Star Wars The Last Jedi is only in front of it, but it's only in front of it by about less than 40 million now. So there is not a lot between those two films. And once you get to that jump, there are a few films you can catch up to reasonably quickly. There's only 4 million between Last Jedi and The Avengers. And then there's a bit of a jump to Jurassic World and Titanic, which have both gone from around the 620 to the 650, 660 kind of million. Look, that's still 100 million away. It's incredibly unlikely that we're going to get there, but these films have such long cinematic releases. Black Panther will still be shown for another month, another 4 weeks. It could well do that kind of thing. It's kind of incredible that it's making it that far. If you look at the all-time rank, so this is any movie at all, Black Panther is currently sitting at number 16 of all time with $1.12 billion. That's international numbers. It's sitting just behind Civil War. So above it, we have Civil War, we have Minions, we have Iron Man 3 that are at the 1.15, 1.2, Iron Man 3 is at 1.2. Look, if this thing makes another 100 million, and it does come up to like the top three domestic releases, it will be sitting just around the top 10, just outside maybe the top 10 movies of all time. Now, obviously, this isn't adjusting for inflation. If you adjust for inflation, we're never going to see anything catch up with something like Gone with the Wind. If you adjust for inflation, Gone with the Wind made something like $1.8 billion, which is just insane. So on that list, you see Black Panther. And this is domestically. This is just in the States. $1.8 billion just in the States, which is just fantastic. Black Panther is currently sitting at number 53. So it's well inside the top 100 films just in the States alone of all time. These kind of numbers are just incredible. So to put it in perspective, it just overtook Batman, 1989 Batman. It took over Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, Finding Nemo, Rogue One, the original Cinderella, Spider-Man 2, My Fair Lady. Like, some of these are amazing films. And just above it, you've got Blazing Saddles, Around the World in 80 Days, Pirates, Dead Man's Chest. Like, it is climbing this ladder very quickly. Like I said, it's currently sitting at $578 million in the States alone. Gone with the Wind is at $1.8 billion. Star Wars is at $1.6 billion. Like, these numbers are just ridiculous numbers. Kind of everything going right at the same time. It's kind of like that gold medal scenario where you need 100 things to go right, and all 100 of those things lined up perfectly. Not only was that film spectacular, but it had no competition. It was around at a time when people loved going to see the movies. Like, it originally made less than $200 million, Gone with the Wind. But it made that in 1939. So this was just before the war. People were still struggling. This was after the Depression. And this was kind of a way that people could escape. Instead of going on a holiday, they would go to the movies. It was far cheaper to take their family to the movies for a day than to go away for a weekend. That was their trade-off. So, like, even the economical situation playing around the world goes into these movies. And things like Gone with the Wind just came at the right time. It was the right movie and everything went well. Star Wars, we know, is a phenomenal success, better than close to any other movie ever. It did something that no one else had ever done. Its fandom is fanatical. It was perfectly done. You then come out to... You drop $300 million and you go down to things like The Sound of Music, E.T., Titanic, Ten Commandments. Like, these are all monster successes. So Black Panther's coming in right now at 53, which is an incredibly impressive run. Incredibly impressive. There's very few films above that made in the last 10 years that can compete. So, look... We're still going strong with the box office of Black Panther. We'll keep you updated. There's a lot of stuff happening there. Trying to keep you updated on Suicide Squad 2. Now, we've seen some behind-the-scenes photos. Potential spoilers, I suppose. Coming from our friends at Bruce Wayne's World, we have a tweet straight from the gym from Joel Kinnaman, who plays Rick Flagg, and some other male co-stars, including Jai Courtney, Captain Boomerang, and Jay Hernandez. Now, Jay Hernandez was the actor that played Diablo, who was meant to have died in the final part of Suicide Squad. Whether they're actually in pre-production together, and they're all in it, we don't know. Those three guys may have just formed a friendship on the set of Suicide Squad. Now they're just trained together or they just work together. I mean, we know that they have directors lined up. It's meant to start production in October of next year. So we're still 15 months away. More than that, we're still 17 months away from October next year. So the fact that you could call this pre-production seems a bit silly. Even if you look at what Hugh Jackman was doing to get in shape for Wolverine, even when he was in his 50s, he was saying it takes 6 to 9 months to get properly in shape from an average level of fitness. And these three actors are certainly at the average level of fitness or above. If anyone saw Altered Carbon, Rick Kinnaman is in phenomenal shape. And Jai Courtney's never really been that overweight. Jay Hernandez, every time I've seen him, has been skinny. Like, so all three of these guys wouldn't need 17 months to get into shape. They would need half that amount, if that. I don't know if this is pre-production or if this is just a happy snap from three guys that are friends in the gym. Hopefully we'll keep you updated. If anything more comes out, we'll let you know. I don't think this points to Diablo being in Suicide Squad 2, although he was lauded as one of the best parts of Suicide Squad 1. I kind of hope they leave it out, only because if you keep bringing back these characters, and DC have kind of done this with things like Superman, you lose the intensity of what a death means. People start watching these films and going, oh, that character's gone. He'll be back soon. Nobody care. Nobody panic. The death of Superman should have been this massive, monumental event, but it lasted a single movie. Like, we knew he was coming back at the end of the first movie. He dies, and at the end of that movie, we see the Earth lift off the coffin. That's what it looks like. That's what they... fans are speculating on for Diablo. Whether we'll get that or not, I don't know. I'm hoping we don't. I'm really hoping he's just there working out with his friends, and they took a snap. Because those actors on the Suicide Squad did form really close bonds. I think all of them have a squad tattoo on them that they each gave each other. I know Margot Robbie's talked about that in interviews. So has Jai Courtney. And Will Smith, they all talked about that extensively. So, look, hopefully they've just all formed a really close friendship and they're all working out together. And that's all this comes to. We've got a bit of exclusive news that says that Gail Simone is going to be writing a new Plastic Man series for DC. I think this is a really cool collab between a character and a writer. Plastic Man is a character that I've only recently come around to. I grew up mostly in Marvel. So coming to DC, things are different. Yes, it's comic books. Yes, it's superheroes. There is a different vibe. There is a different feeling. And it took me a while to kind of understand that vibe and feel that. Plastic Man was one of the characters I didn't get when I first came over. It seemed too wacky. He never seemed to take anything seriously, and I didn't know why. When everyone else is on this earth-shattering experience, like the entire universe is going to die, Plastic Man was kind of there for the ride, didn't really feel... He felt out of place. I then read On the Lam, which is a really cool Plastic Man series. Brilliantly done. Hilarious. And all of a sudden that character made sense. Everything clicked. I understood where they were going, why he was there. And now he's a character that I look forward to in any series I see him in. And I kind of understand the DC world a little more, and I'm trying to get round to reading more and more DC, because I kind of had this sheltered background where I only read Batman. And Batman has a very different vibe to DC as a whole. Which you kind of expect. Every character has their own momentum, their own vibe that the company as a whole doesn't share necessarily. Occasionally you get nice crossovers. I think Superman crosses over quite well with most of DC. So, look, I'm super excited for Gail Simone to write Plastic Man. Big fan of everything Gail's done so far. Look for this. Keep your eyes open. This could be a really fun little series to catch on to. In other news, we have a Marvel writer that has gone on record and said that audiences today would dislike 2008's Iron Man. Now, this has come from a co-writer on Black Panther, Joe Robert Cole, who basically, and I kind of understand his point, he's saying that the socio-political climate we live in today would not resonate with the Tony Stark's Iron Man 1 on screen if that movie didn't happen and this whole MCU didn't kick off in 2008, but it kicked off in 2018. That movie, as it was then, would not work today. Now, part of me says, thank you, Captain Obvious, this is the dumbest thing I've heard in a long time. If you take any movie and just throw it on the screens today as if it was brand new, audiences would be confused and weirded out by it. Or I've spoken previously in this episode about Gone with the Wind making the equivalent of $1.8 billion in the States alone. If that movie was released tomorrow as a brand new, fresh premise, never before seen, but unedited what we know, it would not make anywhere near that kind of money. People expect different things from the characters. Any classic movie wouldn't hold up. Iron Man is a movie that does see a womanizing Tony Stark, kind of dismissive of females, with a black sidekick in Rhodes. And these things, within 10 years even, have had a massive shift in the socio-political climate. We've seen a huge movement in equal rights, equal pay, equal respect for women. Same with people of different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different cultures, religions. We've been saying that these things are equal for decades, but we're only now trying to actually make change and shift towards a more equal future. So it's not surprising that this movie wouldn't do that well, according to this writer. I kind of agree with him. I think Iron Man would still do well. It's got a lot of humor. It's got Robert Downey Jr. Even if he didn't do Iron Man, he would still be doing some acting. People would recognize him as a good actor. It's got Jeff Bridges playing the villain. Jeff Bridges is recognized as a good actor. The movie wouldn't have done as well as it did, but it wouldn't be released as it was. It would have been edited for today's audience. it seems ridiculous that he'd speculate on this. I don't understand what the point of him speculating on this would be. You could argue the same thing for every classic movie. You could argue exactly the same for Citizen Kane, for Casablanca, for Gone with the Wind, for those movies that are held up now by film critics as the best of all time. They wouldn't work if you released them tomorrow. The audience today wouldn't be that fascinated by them. So, thanks, Captain Obvious. Hopefully, on a lighter note, we have Jeffrey Dean Morgan talking about Flashpoint and saying that Batman would be the thrill of a lifetime. Now, I'm hoping, really hoping, that we go through a Flashpoint event where we maybe go into a different universe and Jeffrey Dean Morgan, instead of playing Batman's father, who was shot and killed outside the theatre, he's then playing Batman, and it was Bruce that was shot and killed. We've seen that before in the comic books. We get that flip where the father takes down the villain after his son gets killed, and he turns into the Batman. It's a much darker, much heavier Batman. He's obviously older. It does work. I would love to see Flash run through this reality, link in with Jeffrey Dean Morgan playing Batman, actually get to see him do it. I think Jeffrey Dean Morgan is a really talented actor. I did love what little I saw of him playing Negan on Walking Dead before I gave up that show for a completely different reason. And he has been really fun. I loved watching Supernatural way back in the first like 4 or 5 seasons. I thought were great when he was heavily featured. This is really cool news. I'm hoping, really hoping, that Flash tries to get back home and realizes that time has been changed, that reality has been changed, and that he's a different person in a different universe. Maybe we get rid of Batman, but maybe Wonder Woman is the same. Maybe we can get rid of some of the dead weight. We pick up some new amazing actors. So whether or not he will play it, we don't know. This is pure speculation. He's saying, if I got to play it, it would be a thrill of a lifetime, but nothing's happening at this point. So, look, who knows? Dave has decided to chime in on this point. Hopefully he's got some amazing insight for you guys. Let's see what he's got to say.
Well, thank you, Stu. I'm not sure how amazing my insight will be, other than to say that Jeffrey Dean Morgan, obviously Negan of Walking Dead, also the father of the Winchester boys in Supernatural, not to mention his role as the comedian in Watchmen, one of my favourite actors working. Yeah, he played Batman's father, Bruce Wayne, Thomas Wayne, in Batman vs. Superman for about 2 seconds. And if they did do Flashpoint and they went down that road and you saw the alternate universes, I think he'd be cool. I do say, though, that there's a lot of people out there saying that they really would prefer to see a genuine Flash movie, not Flashpoint in the alternate universes, in which case I think he's far less of a chance. But I do think it's cool that Jeffrey Dean Morgan's down. The ball's in DC's court, whether they just recast and just move on and nothing's happened with Batman, or they bother to do this kind of like flip around, switch around, hullabaloo. I don't know what they'll do. Who knows? But Jeffrey Dean Morgan is a solid casting choice, so it would be kind of cool to see him playing that kind of like casino-owning, I believe, drug-addicted Batman, because he was an older Batman. It was an interesting character in Flashpoint, if no one's read it. And the mother actually becomes the Joker, so it's pretty full-on. So Martha Wayne becomes the Joker. Spoilers for Azzarello's Flashpoint Batman story. But there you go. Yeah, no, I'm definitely down for it. So we'll keep your fingers crossed.
Okay, and we're coming now to weekly comics. So we've got 3 reads this week. Dave is going to do a very brief recap after each one, so you get our perspective on both of them. We start off with Action Comics 999. Now, we're obviously going to be covering Action Comics 1000, which is coming out soon. It's a one-off. It's not connected. It's a kind of a lead-in event that sets the scene. there's a couple of hammy bits in it. So the premise is, it's basically centered around Lois Lane. Lois and Jonathan, the son, her son with Superman, who's, by the way, wearing a cap with 1,000 written on it, which, little over the top, but we'll get there, is inviting her father, Sam Lane, around for dinner, and obviously those two have had a strained, at best, relationship. And this comic basically explores that relationship and why they both feel what they do and why they both act the way they act. Ultimately, Superman is out in space getting rid of an asteroid before it comes and crashes into Earth and potentially causes damage. But while he's there, he finds this mineral, and he says that this mineral is close to indestructible on Earth. So he brings it back to Earth to set up what is essentially a prison for the android Superman version that he previously put in the Phantom Zone. Superman's kind of going through this realization that the Phantom Zone, despite being discovered by Jor-El, is an inhumane prison. It sends people that are already in a fragile mental state over the edge. It breaks them down more than it needs to, and it's detrimental. So he makes this prison, and he finally convinces the android Superman to go in there. It gives him a crystal, allowing him to relive his greatest memories and hopefully rehabilitate himself over time. And the Superman says, you know, do you honestly think that this is going to stop me? Do you honestly think that I won't be able to get out of here? And the answer the Superman gives is basically, no, I think you could, but I'm hoping that you won't want to. I'm hoping that you'll recognize this as an opportunity for rehabilitation and that the person that you once were is not gone. It's a cool concept. He then goes back to Lois and somehow manages to patch up this relationship when Sam is leaving, like storming out in a huff. How he manages to fix a relationship that's been broken for 30 years in about 2 pages, I don't know. He reintroduces them in what I find incredibly condescending way. But look, it's meant to be a feel-good, happy ending. For me, it's okay at best. As a comic, I didn't hate it. I actually quite enjoyed it. Easy to read, really quick to read. I liked the kind of brief action scenes we got between Supes and Android Supes. Jonathan Kent's a bit of a cunt of a kid. Not fun. But look, overall, I'm giving it about a 5 out of 10. Reasonable, but not great. Let's see what Dave's got to think.
Yeah, Weekly Comics, Stu. I noticed Stu didn't do Weekly Comics correctly, but anyway. Action Comics, $9.99. Yeah, I mean, Stu's covered it well. It all starts with Jonathan Kent opening the door with a cap saying 1,000 on it, and I almost threw up. This isn't Deadpool. Superman shouldn't talk to readers like either the characters in his comic or himself and his son, you know, doing it. I thought it was just, I get it's supposed to be fun, and I guess maybe some people out there are excited, but I hated that. But the actual story, as Stu said, is just basically the lack of reconciliation between, is it Sam Lane, Lois's father, and Lois. They've both got different points of view on that. But Superman's reintroduction of the two, where he interests them, like, Sam, I'd like to introduce you to Lois, a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. And then Lois, I'd like to introduce you to Sam Lane, a war hero or something. And then they're like, oh, we love each other, let's sit down for the table. I thought it was just so hammy and sappy and banal, frankly. The art in this issue is sleek. The rest of the story is very competently told by Dan Jurgens, don't get me wrong. I mean, does a professional job, but this was not what I was hoping for. 5.5 out of 10, and it's lucky to get that much. Hopefully, Action Comics 1000 is a lot better. And, you know, we are then going to cover Bendis' run on the title. So it'll be interesting there.
Okay. Second up, we had Avengers 684. Now, this is focusing mostly on the Hulk this week. Really fun read. He's now been reanimated, I suppose, by the Challenger, the brother or the other Grandmaster. And we see this Challenger reanimate Hulk to no longer the Incredible Hulk or the Invincible Hulk. It's now the Immortal Hulk, who is incapable of dying and is separated from Bruce Banner. We do see Dr. Voodoo kind of travelling in and finding Banner's consciousness somewhere. We get this great series of flashbacks looking at how Banner and the Hulk are kind of constantly in this struggle, and Banner wants to end it. We see him figuring out how you can actually kill the Hulk. And he provides Hawkeye with the arrows to kill him and says, "I want you to kill me. This is how you do it." So it kind of validates what happened before. A lot of fans are kind of, how the hell did Hawkeye manage to kill the Hulk? So this kind of settles that. We do see this great little tussle between those two. We also get the big reveal about who the Voyager is. I've speculated previously that she was a villain. Basically, yes. She is actually the daughter of the Grandmaster, and she has been helping him kind of cheat his way through these victories for decades now. So she comes in as a kind of a guest performer, in a way, and rejigs reality so she's in control the entire time, and gradually moves the pieces around this board until he will win. And then he, with the winnings, will give her whatever she wants. So he recently gave her the ability to teleport and the ability to basically inject false memories into people. So it's revealed that because of this illness, this bug that was on Jarvis's brain, Jarvis couldn't receive those implanted memories, but everyone else did, and now they're kind of aware that these memories are fake. Voyager hides herself and the last Pyramoid away in this vault. We don't know why she's doing that, why she's hiding it, why she's not using it for some reason. It feels like she's kind of trying to invalidate this game and ruin it for her father. She wants to be seen as an equal, someone that can actually play the game and win. She wants to be a contender in this competition, to be the next Grandmaster. Look, it's a really fun ride. I thoroughly enjoyed this Avengers. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. I think this was fantastic, seeing the Hulk back. I loved seeing the new Voyager clips. This really worked for me. The art is fantastic, as always, with this series. This was, I think, issue 10 in this series. It's moving along so quickly. I'm loving every second of it. It's really fun to read. I'm going to pass over to Dave and see what Dave thinks.
Just bouncing off what Stu was saying here for Avengers, what was it, 684? Yeah, excellent read. Lots of cool flashbacks to the Hulk's sort of past and his death and resurrection scenes. I really think this is a very interesting storyline they're doing, and it's good to see in such a long storyline they're taking so much time to explore different pieces of the puzzle, all of this leading up to, as we know, Jason Aaron taking over on the title. This is a great issue. Stu's done an excellent recap of the plot details. I won't bore you with that. But I would definitely say to anyone out there who questioned whether Avengers could go weekly, yeah, they can. And Voyager is a really interesting character they're mixing in with the Grandmaster, who I also find very interesting. I like the whole concept of the Grandmaster and the Collector and all those guys playing games and stuff. I think it's cool. I never even knew about it until I saw Ultimate Spider-Man, and they sort of had an episode which ended with Grandmaster and Collector. And I think it's just a really kind of funky, cool part of the... This is the kind of cosmic stuff I actually like. That it's kind of more like a dice game. It's a cool concept. And the Hulk in this is cool. You also got an explanation of how Hawkeye managed to kill the Hulk, which I never... I mean, I didn't read Civil War 2, so I never understood how he possibly did that. But you actually see Banner has told Hawkeye how to kill him, and he's saying, this is how it will work. This will take it past magic and everything. But as it turns out, even that vibranium arrow can be beaten, and Hulk does come back. Very good issue. I didn't hear what Stu gave it because I was busy coughing while he was talking over the last bit, but I'm giving it a solid 8 out of 10, and I give an 8 out of 10 to the whole storyline so far. I think this Avengers No Surrender is a lot better than what I thought it would be. It's a very interesting and cool story.
Okay, and finally, we had Eternity Girl number 1. Now, this was an odd pick for us. This isn't necessarily something that Dave and I would have read had we been given free choice of everything. But I'm glad Dave did pick this one. So, it's focusing on this girl who has kind of phased out of our reality and become this immortal constant. She no longer has a birth and a death. She's just constant throughout the universe. And she's kind of struggling with that immortality. And this is a great look at her trying to find her place and trying to understand what immortality means. She regularly, like once a month, will try to kill herself. It's meant for an older audience. It is a very dark book. Drawn quite lighthearted, and there's a lot of really dark humour in this. We see her, like, she slits her wrists, but there's no blood. She will jump off a bridge and survive the fall. She'll wake up later and just be fine. We've seen her try to overdose. We've seen her try to hang herself. Like, she goes through a laundry list of ways that she has tried to kill herself unsuccessfully. And she doesn't know why or what's happening. It's an incredibly dark look at this superhero kind of genre. She was created to kind of do good with these powers that she's got, which is essentially shape-shifting. But she's struggling to control it now, and she's kind of got this self-doubt racking her mind. It's not something that I would have picked, and it's probably not something that I'm going to continue reading, although I did really enjoy this first issue. I think it was something new, something fresh. If you're interested in something this dark and heavy, go and check it out. It is well worth a read. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10. I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I'd really recommend it. It's not personally for me, but it might be for you, so check it out. We're going to cross over to Dave and see what he thought of Eternity Girl number 1.
Eternity Girl number 1, a new young animal title out of that imprint. Look, I kind of expected, I knew nothing about it, but with the title coming out of Young Animal, I kind of guessed the flavour. It was darker and weirder than I expected. In a good way. What do we think? It's a good read. It's, if I can be brutally honest, often people go for this kind of, like, feel in a book, and it's often, I think Neil Gaiman did it best. There's a Sandman issue, which basically does the same sort of thing. The first time round, he did a powerful version of it. This is another spin on that topic, and it's a very good one. This is actually a very good comic, I thought, very good issue, very solid. It's very out there. This girl basically can't die. She tries to kill herself because she's kind of basically, there's almost nothing left of her. And she makes a really interesting point. They want her to be this stable human being who can also be a thousand different things at once. And it's an impossible task hoisted upon her. And all in all, it's just a really interesting story. I reckon if you're a young person picking this up, not too young, but if you're a teenager picking this up, you might really respond if this is kind of your flavour of comic. I would recommend it. I'd give it a solid 7.5 to 8, anywhere in that range. And it's definitely a very worthy addition to the Young Animal line.
Okay, and finally, we have Trade of the Week, which this week is Conan the Barbarian, The Usurper, numbers 1 through 3. Now, this is the biggest reason this week that I wanted to record a show with Dave. And it's tough that it's just me here and I don't get to bounce anything off Dave. Because this is the first Conan I've ever read. I haven't read any of Robert Howard's Conan. I haven't read any of Conan the Barbarian comics. This one was written by Chuck Dixon, which holds a lot of weight. He is a big friend of the show, and 95% of his work is phenomenally well done. He is one of the most consistently well-performing writers in the comic book industry of all time. I don't know whether this Conan is typical of others. I don't know whether this is a good example or a bad example or where it sits in the Conan mythology. This is something that I'm hoping Dave is going to clear up right after my little review. But unfortunately, I'm recording this before Dave, so I don't know. For me, this is that rare 5% of the time where Chuck misses it. If this is typical Conan, it's not something I want to read. These characters felt one-dimensional at best. It's only a three-issue arc, so it's a really tough call to judge it on a three-issue arc. But we see characters seemingly get introduced because they introduce themselves to Conan, so I'm assuming they're not series regulars. They then die at the end of this three-issue arc, and no thought is given. And fine, he's only met him for a few days, but he meets a woman who he saves and claims as his shield maiden. She dies 2 days later, and he's like on his knees begging for forgiveness, like crying and screaming, and you just, the mood is all over the place. The artwork is fine. It seems okay. It's obviously an older comic, so you kind of read it as a product of the times. Everything felt flat to me. The writing for Conan himself was almost Hulk-like, like Conan Smash, Conan Not Like This. Terrible, terrible stuff. If that is typical of Conan, then sure, it's something that you could grow to like. Obviously, people enjoy the Hulk. When you read the Hulk, you kind of know to expect a Hulk smash. So you like that, and you expect that, and you love it. If that's the case for Conan, I think you could love it. Reading it as a three-issue arc for the first time, this is terrible stuff. You kind of want a leading man to have a little charisma, something to grab your attention. Conan doesn't have that. They would skip over large events, including battles, which you thought would have been right up the alley of these artists and this writer. And you see this kind of emperor sending out his general into battle against Conan, and all of a sudden you cut to the battle is over and the general is now helping Conan. And you just missed the entire scene where those two armies face each other, where Conan wins the respect of this general. You miss all those character moments that could have made this a really cool story. The elements here, there is a skeleton of a cool story here, but it wasn't executed. The supporting cast, the supporting characters are terrible characters. They show up for all of 3 seconds and now they mean the world to Conan and he would die for them, or they mean literally nothing to him and he could forget about them tomorrow. And we have no idea of deciphering which character is going to be which as we meet them. And seemingly the next page, it's just been decided for you, whether you like them or not. It runs quickly. It's a really quick read, and I was grateful for that because it's terrible. This is the worst trade of the week that I have read for this show. I think even things like Crisis on Infinite Earths that Dave and I both didn't like, it suffered from having too many characters, which means that even the best writer in the world, when you have 100 characters in a book, you cannot give any one of those more attention than the others. You can't properly flesh out 100 characters. It's impossible to do in the pages they had. They relied heavily on the reader understanding where all of these characters came from, and if you were a true DC fan, you would have understood where most of those characters came from, and you could influence the reading based on past performance. This Conan book brought in 5 characters that had names, which is such a manageable number, yet you still had zero character development for 4 of them. the only person you saw kind of change was Conan, and he changed in name only. He started out saying, I'm going to be emperor, and by the end of it, he was emperor. It's poor character performance. It's poorly written. I'm so, so glad that I'm currently reading more Chuck in Night Quest, which is Nightfall Volume 2, and I'm absolutely loving it. This, for me, is a rare blip on the radar of Chuck. I'm hoping that this is not the kind of Conan that people are expecting and used to. I'm hoping this is seen as kind of a dip in the Conan mythology. I would like to get back to this character at some stage and read something that I enjoy, because this was a really unfortunate first experience for me with this character. So for me, I'm giving it a 1 out of 10. This did nothing for me. I read it in one night, and it just didn't work on any level. I'm really, really hoping that Dave comes along with his review, and it is glowingly positive, that he absolutely loved it, and that any Conan fans out there can agree with him. I'm sorry to give bad news, but this didn't work for me on any level. So I'm going to pass over to Dave with some hopefully more positive news that we can carry on.
Okay, now here we are discussing Conan the Usurper. I kind of figured this would be an interesting comic to discuss. Firstly, excuse me, and apologies for my illness, by the way. Much like Conan, I'm fighting an enemy, and that enemy is an incredibly bad infection. Okay, now, Chuck Dixon, writing. So, there, straight away, quality. Stephen Lieber on art. on art. Claus Janser on inks. So, a very talented team. It's a three-part story. Basically, this is where they were trying to... Marvel were trying to spin off Conan again after they'd finished the ongoing Conan title in the 90s, along with the Savage sort of Conan, which was the Black and White magazine. I want to put everything in perspective here, because I heard Stu's review, and he's well entitled to his opinions, and he's not a Conan guy. We picked this, and shout out to my friend Dean Compton, who supplied me with the copies for this, because I did appreciate that, because these copies are hard to find. They were limited releases in the 90s. Look, I'm a Conan guy. I've read the Robert E. Howard original stories, and when I read them in about year 2000, I went in with very low expectations. They blew me away and changed the way I looked at writing, and more importantly, how I wanted to write. And I just so responded to it and responded to the character of Conan, who is basically a mercenary, okay, who goes from battle to battle and, you know, acquires and loses things along the way. He is, I love him. He's the ultimate wandering sword. I find it fascinating. He's a thief, a barbarian, a pirate, and eventually even a king. But most of the time, he tends to be selling his sword. And the Savage Sword of Conan titles, which Chuck Dixon wrote, along with many other people, but like he wrote with Gary Kasparitz on art in the 80s, that have been collected in these huge phone book-sized editions, are just some of the best comics I've ever read. And I can't wait to have Chuck on the show to talk about it with him. And a lot of talented people have worked on Conan over the years. So basically, I wasn't aware of this for many years, and I wish I had known it. Conan had a huge life at Marvel as a comic book character from like 1970 right through to the 90s. And then what we're reading here is actually Conan kind of obviously after he's had that huge run, and they've tried to then spin it out into several different titles. And Chuck had this three-shot deal along with several other people. Other people who had little mini-series. Now, unlike Stu, I really enjoyed this story. I do think Stu made a good point. It's the skeleton of a great idea or a great story, and I think it suffers from brevity. I think this could have been a six-parter because it basically tells the story of how Conan goes from being the member of a legion, the Outlanders, kind of like the rabble legion, just a member, and he goes all the way to becoming the king at the end. So this is actually the story of Conan becoming king. And that came as a surprise to me, because I didn't actually expect that. But unlike Stu, I really appreciated this story. I think Claus Janssen's inking is always something to watch. Steve Lieberman art, it has a very Roman feel. As in, unlike most of the Savage sort of Conan written by Chuck that I've read, where he's very much a mercenary and kind of just rolling around fighting the Picts and fighting as a gladiator, this is a different period of Conan where he's dressed in kind of imperial armor. They're fighting the Picts in the forest, and then basically their army turns on them, and then Conan leads the charge all the way back to the capital. So basically, it's a story of an army that mutinies and then falls under Conan's control, and finds its way all the way to the capital, and he ends up killing the emperor and seizing the throne in the final scene. Look, the thing with Conan is there's always a lot of supporting characters that come and go. And much like in this, so the guys are often there. It's very much like a TV show. Guys pop in for an episode or two, and they tend to cycle out pretty quickly. The women definitely come and go as well. It's a feature of Conan. He is a very expansive character in some ways and a very kind of one-liner character in others. And in this one, he is kind of, it's the more the man of few words Conan. Sometimes he speaks a bit more, but this one, he's very much a man of few words. I would say this is a very professional job by the Dixon Lieber team. And it tells a tight story. And I think Conan fans will probably appreciate it more than just someone walking in off the street like Stu. The only reason we picked this particular story was I'd just gotten a hold of the issues. And I was interested in myself. And I wanted to give Stu a little quick three turnaround because we're doing Night Quest next week, the Nightfall Volume 1. So that's why I went for a very brief story. Looking back on it, I probably should have picked a longer story or one of the black and white stories that I really love. This is it's a decently told, you know, good Conan story. It's not going to blow your mind. I mean, I'd give it a solid 7.5 out of 10. I was interested, actually. I wish there'd been like a six-parter. And to be honest, when we get Chuck on next time, I'm going to ask him about what it was like. I've got a lot of questions for Chuck about the 80s run of Conan on Savage Sword, which I thoroughly recommend. Get those Savage sort of collections from Dark Horse. They're fantastic. And then I'll also ask a question about what it was like trying to reboot the character in the 90s and if he remembers that at all. Because basically after a series of like mini-series, they sort of retired the character and Dark Horse bought the rights back off them until literally this year. So this was kind of the last gasp at Marvel of Conan. And I believe from what Dean was saying, had a very limited release. So this is kind of more a curiosity amongst Conan fans. Next time when I have a Conan story for Stu and I'll give him a real kind of classic story where Conan, I prefer Conan as a full-on mercenary, sort of fighting in the gladiator pits and, you know, the women, et cetera, like the whole package. This was kind of more a very grim Conan. And Conan's never normally too loquacious, but it's particularly grim Conan. No, but I enjoyed it. I you know, Stu gave it a 1 out of 10. That's crazy. You know, but that's a guy, like, who's put in a huge show, a huge solo show. So props to Stu in general for the show, but 1 out of 10 was crazy. This is a solid 7.5 out of 10. And as a Conan fan, you might even slightly higher, mark it higher. But it's not where I would start if I was reading Conan for the first time. In fact, if I was reading Conan for the first time, I'd recommend two things. Go and read the Robert E. Howard stories, and check out the classic comics, particularly Savage Sword of Conan, because they're fantastic. The black and white magazines that went from the 70s right through the 80s are just fantastic. I've read so many of them recently, and it's like heaven to me. So wrapping up, I'll turn back to Stu to close the show up. But thank you for your time. Thank you for putting up with my wheezy voice. I hopefully will be fine by our next show, or at least markedly improved. This is coming to you direct from quarantine, like sickness. And thank you very much as well to Stu for doing what he's done this show, which was a huge effort. And he's proven that he truly is the main man. Thank you and good night. I'll see you next week, guys. Bye-bye.
Okay, guys, that'll do it for this week on The Signal. Hopefully you've been okay with me hosting. I'm sorry about that. Hopefully Dave gets better soon. We do miss him here. Well, I miss him here. Next week, coming up, we have Batman Nightfall Volume 2, Night Quest. Hopefully you've been reading it for a while. It is a monster read to get through. It is a good three times the length of most Trade of the Weeks that we do. I'm currently sitting about a third of the way through, loving it. So I'm looking forward to reading the rest of that. To give you a heads up, in the coming episodes, so episode 54, next week we have Night Quest. After that, we have a Pacific Rim tale. Tales from the Drift is going to be our episode 55 to tie in with the release of Pacific Rim Uprising. We're then going to get back to 52 Volume 2 in episode 56. We're going to attempt to get through 52 as quickly as we can. I know that's certainly helpful for me, who hasn't read it before, and Dave hasn't read that before either. So it's great that we're getting through that quickly. After that, we have 2 weeks of Avengers in the lead-up to Infinity War, which is going to be the biggest release of, hopefully, the last 10 years. I'm seriously looking forward to that. So we've got quite a few exciting weeks coming up on The Signal. Please let us know what you loved, what you liked about the show, what you thought of some of the news, what you thought of Dave not being here. I miss him. So let us know. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. You can email us. We're on YouTube. Jump, give likes, subscribe. Everything's going to be up there. Please let us know what you thought. Hopefully everything works out all right and Dave's back next week and we can do Night Quest together. I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully you guys are as well. Until then, have a great week. Keep reading and I'll see you later.